A famous, not such a famous, but a darshan, a preacher who went from town to town, because that was his parnasa, and the only drasha that he had was on Parshas Korach. He only had one prepared drasha, so he had to figure out how to talk about Parshas Korach every single week. Very difficult. So the story goes, he had a little dog that he would go with him, and the dog would start barking as soon as he began to talk. So he said, "That dog, I wish the ground would swallow him up like Korach," and then that was his excuse to talk about Korach. But I'm going to talk about Korach, but also the Haftarah of Korach. And first, it's very, very interesting that there are some direct parallels between the story of Korach and the Haftarah. The Haftarah deals with the re-coronation of Shaul HaMelech, meaning Shaul HaMelech was already chosen, but many people were not satisfied with him. They wanted a different king. And also, let me remind you that Shaul is from the tribe of Binyamin. And a very short time before Shaul HaMelech was chosen, there was a civil war against Binyamin in the very sad incident of Pelegish Begiva. Binyamin was almost totally decimated. Many people hated the tribe of Binyamin, and the fact that the first king chosen by Hashem was from Shevet Binyamin was not acceptable by many people. And then there was a war with Nachash, the king of Ammon, and there was a miraculous victory, and people saw that Shaul HaMelech was blessed by Hashem, and therefore there was what was called Chidush Hamlucha, meaning a reinstitution of the Malucha. But the Haftorah is very schizophrenic, because on one hand, the Chidush HaMelucha is there to suggest that now everybody is so happy that Shaul is Melech. All the people who thought Shaul wouldn't be a good king were proven wrong. And therefore this was acclamation as opposed to the coronation that was not accepted by so many people. The Haftorah tells us there was a Simcha Gedola. But there was unfortunately one person who was not very happy about it, and that was Shmuel. And Shmuel puts a pretty sad damper on the occasion that after this great victory of Nachash b'nei Ammon and after the great acclamation that Shaul is Melech and we accept him, Shmuel reminds him and he restates the speech that he gave the first time around, that if you truly had Emuna, you would have let Hashem be your king and not turn to a Melech Basar V'dam. So the Haftarah has two opposite feelings. There's a feeling of tremendous simcha and jubilation, but then there is Shmuel's musar that a king is not inherently desirable. Now, let me first articulate the connection to Korach, and then we'll look at some aspects of the Haftarah itself. First, the story of Korach is, of course, a rebellion against Moshe Rabbeinu, a refusal to accept the authority of the one who was designated as the Shaliach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Korach's argument is one of what you might call, and it actually resonates today, radical egalitarianism. Korach's argument is, who needs leaders? Who needs gedolim? Who needs people to tell us what the Torah means? Ki kol ha'eda kulam kedoshim. Everybody's equal. Right? There was a famous politician in the United States, famous governor of Louisiana, who was, you know, almost turned, he was kind of a fascist in a way, but Huey Long. And his motto was, every man a king. And he got this from Korach, Kol Eda Kulam Kedoshim. But you know, the funny thing is, on one hand, Korach is calling for equality, but really, it's just a power struggle in which he wants to be charged. If you look at Rashi, the concept is not that Korach wants everybody to be equal, Korach wants himself to be a boss. And this is really the history of almost all revolutions in which people try to upset the existing order by making a claim of equality and freedom for everybody. But really, it's only a question of substituting one power for another power. And this was the insight that was recognized by the Eishes Chayil of Mrs. Own Ben Peles. If you remember, Own Ben Peles was kind of an active revolutionary, and then he seems to have dropped out of sight in a good way, meaning he didn't fall into the ground. The other way around, he just rejoined Am Yisrael. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin gives us the backstory of Own Ben Peles, where, you know, Korach is making this argument, we're all holy, we're all equal. And On Ben Pelas jumps on the bandwagon and says, yeah, you know, I can be a Rosh Hashiva too. But Mrs. On says to him, you know, On, if Korach wins, you'll be a nobody. And if Moshe wins, you'll be a nobody. He says, you're going to be a nobody. Again, tough words, perhaps. You're going to be a nobody no matter who wins. What's the point here? And On recognized. Then the Gemara has another story that when they came to talk to On, she uncovered her hair, and they had, even then, even the rebellers had Yerushalayim not to go in, etc. And the Gemara contrasts the wife of On ben Pelas to the wife of Korach, who played on his gaiva and played on his desire for kavod. And she inflamed the flames, she inflamed the passions, causing Korach's eventual destruction. So this is an important lesson anyway, that beware of hidden agendas, that often people who try to be mezalzel in the need for leadership are not really that interested in your ideas or my ideas. They're interested in their ideas. And this is the history of revolutions politically. The French Revolution, overthrowing the excesses of the monarchs in the interests of liberté, égalité, fraternité. And you had Robespierre. The Russian Revolution, right? Let's get rid of the czars and establish a society to each according to their needs. And you have a Lenin and a Stalin, who were really much worse than the czars were. And this is the way it goes. The hidden agenda of people who seek equality are often seeking a power. Again, if I could use a secular analogy to this, some of you might have read George Orwell's book, Animal Farm, which was his parody, really, of the Russian Revolution, where the animals overthrow the people, but eventually they become as dictatorial as that which they tried to overthrow. This is exactly the story of Korach. But Korach does represent the notion of really rejecting HaKadosh Baruch Hu by rejecting Hashem Sholiach. And the parallel is, the Jewish people were rejecting the spiritual, ruchniistic leadership of Shmuel as a Sholiach Hashem, in favor, not of equality, that wasn't there, but in favor of a human and political system. And therefore the parallel is, just as the Jews were nenash because they rejected Moshe, there was a miracle when they rejected Shmuel. Of course, the miracle wasn't the same. In Korach's case, the ground opened up and 250 people died with fire. But Shmuel also had a miracle showing Hashem's dissatisfaction. If you remember what Shmuel said at the end of his speech, that Hashem will show his dissatisfaction because today is the time of the wheat harvest around Shavuos when it normally doesn't rain. And all of a sudden there were dark clouds and thunder and lightning, and Hashem showed his dissatisfaction. So the rebellion is the same. The miracle showing divine dissatisfaction is the same. But what's interesting is, an interesting reverse paradox, and that is, remember that Shmuel himself is descended from Korach. In fact, according to the Medrash, the reason why Korach thought he might be successful is he saw with Ruach HaKodesh that Shmuel would come from him. And Shmuel himself is considered to be as great as Moshe and Aaron. So Korach figures, the apple can't fall far from the tree. Gee, if I have such a great descendant, must be because of me. And therefore he figured his kavod would entitle him. But there's a mida keneged mida. Korach rebels against Moshe. So B'nai Yisrael rebel against a descendant of Korach. In other words, Shmuel, in effect, suffers this humiliation as kind of a kapara for what Korach did to Moshe Rabbeinu. So there is also a mida keneged mida attribute. Let me point out as well that although this is really Shmuel's farewell speech, and he talks about how old and aged he is, you do know that the Gemara tells us Shmuel died at the age of 52. Shmuel died as a very relatively young man, and yet he had the appearance of looking very, very old. Some say that people shouldn't think of him as young, because then they would consider him a sinner for dying so young. But he still died extraordinarily young. In fact, there's a very striking vort from the Arizal. I think I may have mentioned it before. If you remember, in the Haggadah of Pesach, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah teaches us about the mitzvah of reciting the story of Mitzrayim at night. So he uses the lashon, "Behold, I am like a man of 70. And the Gemara explains that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was actually 18 years old, but he was elected to be the head of the Sanhedrin after Rabbi Gamliel was deposed because of an argument. And since people might not respect a man who looked so young, Hashem made him age prematurely, and as a result, he says, I am like a man of 70. This is what the Gemara says. The Arizal says that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was a reincarnation of the Navi Shmuel. Shmuel left the world at the age of 52. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was born with a 52-year-old neshama. Therefore, when he was 18, his neshama was 70 years old on this earth. That's Harei Ani Kaven Shivim Shana. Why Shmuel died so young is actually a bit of a mystery. Chazal give a number of possibilities. One is that Shmuel was deeply grieved that his sons were not as righteous as him. Now, there's actually a machlokas in the Midrashim. Were his sons actual sinners, like Bnei Eli? Again, that's so it's like an interesting idea, because Shmuel was chosen because the sons of Eli were not behaving properly. Shmuel's own sons were not behaving properly. Or no, Shmuel's sons were actually very, very righteous, but they were not on the madrega of their father. In fact, according to many Midrashim, the Navi Yoel, one of the books of the Treyasar, is a son of Shmuel. And although he's described as Yoel ben Pisuel, with a pay, Pisuel, but Pisuel is understood as one of the names for Shmuel, because Pituel means Mifatekel, he is able to entice God for mercy. So according to that, Shmuel did have a great son, but it was not on the Madrega of Shmuel himself. So according to one interpretation, it was because of the Tsar over his sons not being able to take his place. According to another interpretation, and this is strange to hard to understand, it's because of a miswording of Chana's tefillah. Because Chana made a deal with HaKadosh Baruch Hu when Chana was barren for many years. Chana said, if you give me a child, I will give him to Hashem ad olam, which normally means forever. But we know in the Lashon of the Torah, Olam refers until the Yovel, until the Jubilee, which is 50 years. Like we say by an Eved, right? If an Eved's ear is pierced, and normally an Eved Ivri goes free after 6 years. If he wants to stay longer, his ear is pierced, and he stays as an Eved Liolam, and that means until the Jubilee year. So Chana misspoke. Chana used the word Olam, and Olam means 50 years, and since she gave him to Eli at the age of 2, he had 50 years of service. What we take from that is not so clear. I mean, it's difficult. The truth is these midrashim are very, very difficult to understand, because it's almost as if, you know, God is playing a game with you, meaning to say you use the wrong word and you get trapped. It's hard to clearly understand what is going on here, but it does indicate that one has to be very, very careful not to be overly precise in their tefillos. Now, don't give, you know, a number of years or a period of time, because that could turn out to be a negative thing, but you basically just ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the brachos and the like. By the way, Derek Agav, another very extraordinary thing that Chana asked for, and this one can really think about. She asked Hashem for what's called Zera Anashim, a child of people. Well, what does that mean? Every human child is a child of people. So the Gemara gives two interpretations. One interpretation means a man among men, meaning a man that will stand out, a person that will be exceptional in wisdom and nevuah and koach, which we understand that. That's a wonderful thing to ask for. But there's another pshat in the Gemara, which is very surprising. Zera Anashim means, God, give me an average person. Somebody who doesn't stand out. Somebody who's not too smart and not too dumb. I mean, what type of tefillah is that? I mean, you know, Baruch Hashem, well, one has to be grateful for everything Hashem gives you. But once you're there, you know, you're asking, why do you ask for mediocrity? And of course, in that sense, was her prayer answered? If that's what she wanted, she certainly didn't get that. Right? What's the pshat? So the pshat is like this. There's something very, very deep here. Of course she didn't want a mediocre person. She wanted a person who would be an Eved Hashem all of his life. But she said, I want him to be normal. I want him to be a person that's able to relate to people, a person who's able to talk to people, a person who's able to understand. Because sometimes you can have a person who is so above everybody's madrega that nobody can relate to him. He doesn't understand the struggles people have. You know, somebody comes to a tzaddik, you know, who lives on a crust of bread and sleeps 1 hour a week and says, I don't have any money. And the tzaddik says, what's the problem? You don't need any money. You know, I mean, in other words, the point she basically said is, let him be a person who understands the struggles of human beings. And let him be normal. Let him be a ma'uriv bein abrios. In fact, in the yeshiva world today, this is actually a phrase many mashgichim are saying. So they're saying to kids, be normal. Not so easy. So that's part of her tefillah as well. That in his godless, and of course the emes is, I mean, I was zocha as a little child to not know, but really have some interaction with Rav Moshe Feinstein. He used to visit Hartford, Connecticut. And I tell you, Rav Moshe was normal. I mean, there are pictures of him wearing a fireman hat playing with his grandchildren. He says he remembered everybody's birthday, you know, English and religious. You know, these things that you wouldn't associate with a gadol. There was a certain aspect that, besides knowing Kol HaTorah Kula and being able to paskin on any conceivable shaila and going through Shas, you know, 1,000 times and the Prima Gadim 600 times, with all of that, there was a concept of understanding the struggles of regular people. And this, I think, is a very deep, profound thing that Chana was praying for. But be it as it may, going back to why Shmuel aged, according to some Midrashim, is because Chana made the fatal step of using the word olam, right? I will give him to Hashem, liolam. But be it as it may, Shmuel aged prematurely. Shmuel gave them a big speech the first time they asked for a king, how bad it was, and I'll talk about that for a moment. And now that there's chidush hamlucha, he brings it up again at a time when everybody is so jubilant and joyous over the victory of Nachash. Now, one other connection between Korach and the Parsha of Shmuel, the Haftarah of Shmuel, is that if you remember when Moshe is accused of usurping leadership, and Korach says, everybody's equal, everybody's the same, who needs leaders? By the way, it reminds me a little bit, I remember when I was in Washington, when they had the World Trade Organization, which is an international organization to unify trade. So a lot of people were against it because they felt it would affect sovereignty of individual nations, that you'd have this international organization that would be making decisions. So a particular group that was against it was the International Association of Anarchists. And they wanted to organize a demonstration, but they couldn't do it because they couldn't get organized. Actually, the demonstration didn't work. I remember it was reported that they just couldn't get people together. No, they're anarchists. Well, again, Korach is arguing spiritual anarchy. But if you recall, Moshe Rabbeinu right away talks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, I have never taken anything for my personal gain. I have not taken a donkey. I have not used people. I have not abused my power for my personal gain. That is echoed exactly in Shmuel. Shmuel HaNavi says, and he speaks to the people, tell me, have I ever taken anything of yours? And the people shout out, you have not. And then there's a singular, Vayomer A, and he said, I am a witness. According to Chazal, it was Hashem himself talking. I will be the witness. The Gemara even says that Shmuel went Lifnim Ishuras Adin, that although Shmuel spent most of his years traveling, riding circuit, Shmuel went all over Eretz Yisrael to adjudicate cases and to help people. Shmuel took his entire household with him. He took his own food, he took his own bedding, he took his own tent. Shmuel did not accept any hospitality, any food, any drink from anyone. So it's not just a question of not oppressing people. Now the Gemara, by the way, contrasts Shmuel with Eliyahu and Elisha. It's interesting. Eliyahu and Elisha used to accept hospitality from people. If you remember, that's the case where Eliyahu revived the widow because she used to give him a room, etc. And the Gemara Taka says that different chachamim and tzaddikim had different behaviors in this regard. Some would accept hospitality because they felt it would be showing people honor. To, you know, it's a chesed to them to accept the hospitality they want to show you. And others, like Shmuel, were so scrupulous that they would take nothing at all. Now, the Gemara seems to indicate either way is a good midah, but one might answer with fi pshat that there's a great difference between a navi and a judge. Shmuel was a navi, but Shmuel was also a judge. And Eliyahu and Elisha were not judges per se, and as a result, a judge doesn't take things from people because that might be a bribe. In fact, Rav Yashiv, he should be well, was, you know, professionally, he was a dayan for many, many years. Now he's in retirement, but he's still basically a dayan. And he does not accept matanas, even little things like people bring him a jar of honey for Rosh Hashanah. You know, if somebody drops something off, he will send his grandchildren to pay for it. He says he will not take a single gift from anyone. If people come and do electric work or whatever they do in the house, you know, and they want to give him a little discount, he says he refuses to take it. He says he will find out. I mean, even he'll be mevatel Torah to find out what the prevailing price for those things are, and he will pay. He says he, and part of the reason that's given is that he considers himself to be a 24/7 status of a dayan, and therefore he does not take any gifts from anyone. This is could be why Shmuel was so mocked. Right, so we have all of these connections. The rebellion against Shmuel parallels the rebellion against Moshe. The miracle of Shmuel causing the rain parallels the miracle of the earth swallowing. The notion of absolute honesty in your position, L'shem Hashem, Moshe and Shmuel. In fact, the words are very the same. The words are virtually identical. The same type of notion that I don't use my power for my personal use, but only for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And finally, the reverse connection that Shmuel, as a descendant of Korach, must suffer the same humiliation as Moshe, who is criticized by Korach, and Shmuel, the descendant of Korach, is humiliated by Bnei Yisrael. All of this. Of course, it's interesting that the miracle of Korach was a miracle that Moshe decreed on his own, meaning Hashem didn't tell him this would happen. Moshe was really playing with dice here, because Moshe Rabbeinu said that if Hashem chose me, then you will die in an unusual way and the ground will open up. Hashem didn't say that. Huh? And here as well. That's the same thing. Both of them are tzaddik gozer of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekayim, and that's they have bitachon in their shlichas. Let me just share with you a short verse from the Shem Mishmuel, in the name which is explaining an enigmatic passage of the Arizal. The Arizal says, he gives you a gematria, but he doesn't explain the meaning of the gematria. Korach is begematria 308. Korach. Moshe is the gematria 345, right? Moshe. The difference between 308 and 345 is 37, and 37 is the gematria of Hevel, Kayan's brother who got killed. So if you put this together arithmetically, Korach plus Hevel equals Moshe, or Moshe minus Hevel equals Korach. Okay, this is what the Arizal says. The Arizal does not go any further as to what's the connection here. So the Shem Shmuel offers a very beautiful connection. Let's go back to Kayin and Hevel. Kayin and Hevel, the word Kayin, the first son of Chava, or at least the oldest twin, is because she said, Kanisi ish, Im Hashem, and that means I have made, I acquired. Kanisi in the Chumash means I have created. Koneh Shemayim Va'aretz does not mean Hashem acquires heaven and earth. It means he created heaven and earth. So Kayin, which means I have created, represents that impulse in man, which is to create, to take the raw materials of the world, improve on them. It represents the ego within man, which seeks to create. Now, that intrinsically is not a bad impulse, but it can lead to gaiva and arrogance and rebellion against Hashem. But Kayin is the kayach of ego, which in a good direction leads to productivity and accomplishment, but in a bad direction leads to gaiva and merida. Hevel means vapor, vanity, nothingness. In Kohelet, Shlomo HaMelech says over and over again about this world, Havel Havalim, Hakol Hevel. Hevel represents humility and submission. The recognition that I'm nothing without HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In the good way, that results in submission to God. But the negative is, it creates passivity. It's kind of whenever there's a problem in the world, you know, Hashem Yazor. In other words, you don't drain the swamps, you don't try to cure disease, you don't even try to help the poor because you say Hashem will do everything. Yeah. That's why, by the way, if you think about this, the one who created the idea of korbanos, the one who had the insight, whatever that means, that Hashem wanted korbanos, was not Hevel. It was Kayin. Because from Hevel's perspective, who am I to dare bring HaKadosh Baruch Hu a korban? I'm a nothing. There's nothing I can do. It was Kayin's gaiva that gave him the Pesach. Huh, I can give Hashem something. It's only when Kayin did it, but didn't do it right, that Hevel then recognized this is something that's good, and I have to improve on it. So Kayin actually represents the koach of innovation, initiative, leadership, autonomy. Hevel represents nothingness and humility. Hevel dies. Hevel was a righteous, pure person who totally was mavatal himself to Hashem. But his neshama needed a tikkun. He needed to take the modesty and not use it as a passivity and a withdrawal from the world. But he needed to take his modesty and recognizing that everything comes from Hashem, become a leader of men. The Arizal writes, Moshe Rabbeinu was a Gilgal, was a reincarnation of Hevel. Moshe Rabbeinu too was the Anav Mikol Adam. No one was more humble than Moshe Rabbeinu. But Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who took us out of Mitzrayim. Moshe Rabbeinu got us the Torah. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu did not allow his humility to obscure his mission. It did not allow his humility to basically say Hashem will take care of everything. Moshe Rabbeinu understood that to be a Shaliach Hashem means we have to do what we can in the world. And that was a tikkun for the passivity of Hevel, giving Hevel an aliyah. So the Shemesh Shmuel goes on and says that Korach had all of the kochos of Moshe Rabbeinu, the brilliance, the understanding, but the only quality that Korach lacked was the quality of humility of Hevel. Therefore, Moshe minus the Hevel gives you Korach. Korach plus the Hevel gives you Moshe. So seen in this way, the Shemesh Shmuel says, Korach, well, he doesn't use this phrase, but Korach is truly the prototype of the Greek tragedy. Right? The Greek tragedy is the very heroic person who has a fatal flaw. Korach was very, very great. Korach was great in wisdom, great in understanding. According to the Medrash, Korach even understood Parah Aduma, the mysteries of Parah Aduma. Everything was clear to him. A man of unimaginable greatness. But because of the desire for kavod that was inside of him, he was destroyed. He would have been a Moshe had he had the quality of Hevel. But not having the quality of Hevel, it became destroyed. In fact, that's, the word korach, kireach, actually means to be, when a person's bald, that means when things are pulled away from you that you should have. And as he was a kireach from the quality of Hevel. In fact, this is the explanation of the famous medrash that Rashi brings, that Korach asked Moshe Rabbeinu to ridicule the Torah, ridicule Moshe. He asks Moshe Rabbeinu, what if people have a talus that's totally techeles? If a talus is totally techeles, blue, do you have to have any tzitzis on it? And Moshe said, yeah, you have to have tzitzis. So Korach said, that doesn't make sense. If one string of techeilus is enough to be yotze, then the whole talis is techeilus. Why do I need more strings? And this was his argument. Now, the Mefarshim say the following idea. You look at your tzitzis, a person looks at his talis, and you have white strings and you have blue strings. Now, I'm not going to get into the halachic issue of whether today we have techeilus. As you know, this is a very live machlokas. But the Torah does require on a talis that you have a combination of white strings and blue strings that are dyed from a very specific source called the chilazon, a type of shellfish probably. And we've lost that chilazon over the years, and there's a big machlokas, do we have it or don't we have it? And that's why some people wear techeilus, some people don't. There are two primary sources for those who claim to have techeilus. There is radziner, breast liver techeilus, which is from the cuttlefish, which is not a shellfish. And then there's the other techeilus from seal techeilus, which is from the murex trunculus, which is a shellfish, and the like. But be it as it may, originally you certainly have to have techeilus. Now Rashi brings from the Medrash, why do you have techeilus? Because techeilus reminds me of the sea, and the sea reminds me of the sky, and the sky reminds me of the Kisei HaKavo, the divine throne. So when I look at the tzitzis, I think of my connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Derech Agav, the Bali Musar raised the question, why do you have these intermediate steps? Just say, when I look at the techeilus, I think of the Kisei HaKavo. Why? The sea. The answer is, you see from here, that spiritual development should proceed gradually. Don't jump to the highest madriga right away. Don't look at your tzitzis and think, oh, I'm with Hashem. That it's like building, you know, you can't build the 100th story unless you have 99 stories supporting it. And sometimes we like to skip steps and just go to the end. If you saw Cilantro used to say, it's like the person who says, you know, I want to learn Shas. That's a good goal. Everybody can do that. Then a person says, but I want to learn Shas in one night. He says, most people cannot do that. The Vilna Gaon could learn Shas in one night. Then he said, but somebody wants to learn Shas in one night and sleep 8 hours that same night. He says, he doubts even the Vilna Gaon could have gotten away. I don't know, maybe the Vilna Gaon could, but the Vilna Gaon, of course, never slept more than 2 hours anyway. But he says, we want the final results without all the work. So you start off with the sea and the sky, you know, and then you go to the Kisei HaKavod. But be it as it may, why do you have a mixture of white and blue? If the blue reminds me of my connection to God, the white, which at least visually, if not by the laws of physics, is the absence of color, I understand that white is a combination, but there's no, reminds me that I haven't made it yet, meaning blue is what I can achieve. White is the reminder that I haven't yet achieved it. Your relationship with Hashem, but how much more there is to go. Korach only believed in techeilus. Korach believed that he achieved the complete relationship. Korach didn't understand the idea of lavan, of the white. And that goes back to the Shem Mishmuel, that the techeilus represents the ruchniyistika koach that a person has. But without the white, without the anava, without the humility, you will not be able to achieve anything. Chazal talk about this over and over again. Yeravam ben Nevat, who was the hand-picked king of the 10 tribes, al pi Hashem, Achia Hashiloni, great, great Navi. Yeravam was chosen by Hashem. Remember, we can't forget this. Yeravam was chosen by Hashem to be the king of the 10 tribes. And then we know, however, that Yeravam degenerated. He put up golden calves that people would worship. He didn't allow people to go to the Beis Hamikdash in Yerushalayim. And he is the prototype for Chayte Umachti, not only one who sins, but one who is machti as a rabbim. He causes others to sin. And the Gemara says the Shirish was a gaiva. HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to Yeravam ben Nevat and says to Yeravam ben Nevat, Yeravam, do tshuva! And you, I, and David HaMelech will walk together in Gan Eden. And Yeravam says, who's going to be first? And Hashem said, well, David HaMelech will be first. He says, I don't want the deal. Forget it. If I'm not going to be first, I don't want anything. Actually, the Bali Musar said he was actually even questioning, should Hashem be first? That's how crazy it was. Are you going to be first? He says, no. He says, I don't want it. Okay. So this is a part of some of the lessons of Korach, which really the way that Gaiva can destroy everything that's good. Actually, it was Ronald Reagan, of all people, who said a very nice statement a number of years ago. He said, there is no end to the amount of good that can be accomplished in the world if you don't really care who gets the credit for it. That one shouldn't think about who gets credit. I mean, the Kodesh Baruch Hu knows what we did, what we didn't do. The main thing is to do good things in the world and not really care. In fact, this is what Rebbe Kiv Eger said. Rebbe Kiv Eger said, what is the meaning of humility? So he makes the point, a very important point. Humility does not mean you look at yourself poorly. When Moshe is the most humble of all people, what, he thought he was like dumber than, you know, anyone else in Klal Yisrael? I mean, he knew that wasn't the case. And if he thought that, that would not be something to praise. That would be a delusional thing. I mean, that would have been insanity. I mean, do you praise somebody for being crazy? There's no mila for him to think, oh, I'm worse than everybody else. Rebbe Kiv Eger says the real idea of humility is that you don't think about yourself a lot at all. You focus on the tasks that need to be done in life. And you don't think about, gee, it's so wonderful that I did this, and you don't think, gee, I'm so bad that I didn't do this. You kind of don't have that in your thinking. What you're doing is you're focusing on the good, and you get joy when good things are done, and you get joy when you do good things, and you get joy when other people do mitzvahs. Meaning in many, many ways, if life is about Kiddush Hashem, then whenever Hashem's name is sanctified, that's a source of pleasure. If I do it, I'm happy. And when you do it, I'm happy. And it really doesn't make a difference if I do it or you do it, as long as it gets done. That is the idea of anava. It's like an awareness that we're all given gifts, we're given potential. And we don't necessarily, you know, think about, you know, brownie points. Am I doing good? Am I doing bad? We don't take a score that way. Yeah.
Regain the teaching to that is no longer being heard.
Yeah.
According to an example like Korach and so on and so forth, how do we fix what's broken?
Well, I wish I had a magic solution. I think that, you know, you have to start. We have to start in our families with our children when they're very young, to give them, you know, self-esteem and self-respect. But also give them the idea that doing good is its own reward. That doing good is not because people will praise you and people will love you, but because you're making Hashem happy, and that's a good thing. You know, the Chazon Ish gives a mashal which may make us a little uncomfortable, but it's an interesting mashal to think about. Not everybody agrees with this mashal, but this is the mashal that he gave. He says, let's imagine that you or your husband loves to have guests for Shabbos. Right? You love Hachnasas Orchim. You do this mitzvah very, very conscientiously with a great deal of care. And it's Friday night and there's no Oireach. You don't have any guest. And finally the husband sees somebody in Shul who seems to be alone, and he's so happy. And he goes over to the person and says, Baruch Hashem, Reb Yid, I hope I can have the sechus to have you over my house for Shabbos. And the person tells you, oh, thank you so much, but just 1 minute ago, somebody invited me. Okay, so the Chazon Ish says, litmus test. Do you feel bad or do you feel good? So the Chazon Ish says, if your real feeling was somebody is in need and it's important that he be taken care of, then you should be just as happy if he's someone else's house than yours. Thank God, Baruch Hashem, you have a place. If, on the other hand, the chesed becomes an egotistical thing, you know, I'm hospitable. All right, now listen. Obviously, it's much, much better to do chesed than not to do chesed. That's what the Gemara says in many cases. Doing a mitzvah shalom l'shma brings a person to higher levels. But the Chazon Ish says one should recognize that if there's this idea that I have to be the one that does it, says there's a shtickle shalom l'shma in that type of thing. Right? So Rebbe Kiv Eger says, Anava does not mean thinking of yourself as a nothing. Lehepach. If you think of yourself as a nothing, you'll never accomplish anything. Right? You'll be like Hevel originally, that notion of passivity. To recognize your strengths, recognize the uniqueness of your contribution, and then get a joy in the fact that Hashem is being served by what you're able to do. Right? That is the idea of Anava, to be a task-oriented person, and not a person who every decision is a referendum as to how I'm doing today. Good, bad, you know. You don't think in those terms at all. Just do the good that you can do in the world. And that can make a very, very big difference. Now, coming back to the Haftarah, I just want to talk briefly on really what is one of the major themes in the book of Shmuel. And that is, L'chaira, in Parshas Shaftim, in the book of Devarim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us to have a melech. Som tosim alecha melech. It is actually one of the 613 commandments in the Torah. Now, the Jews did not appoint a melech till they were in Eretz Yisrael for more than 300 years. And when they asked for a king, Shmuel, the last of the Shoftim, criticizes them and said, you have a lack of faith, you have a lack of emunah. The Torah itself says, and the Rambam so paskins, that appointing a king is a mitzvah in the Torah. You have to appoint a king. So there are many, many mahalchim that the Rishonim give to answer this question. And the general mahalach is that actually having a king is not an avera. Having a king is a mitzvah. But the reason why the Jewish people wanted a king was the problem. It was not the king per se, but it was the reason. It says they wanted a king like all the nations of the world, although that's not really a good answer because that's in the Torah itself. But they said they want a king to judge us, meaning they wanted a political system instead of a Torah system. They want a king because they lacked faith that Hashem would protect them. Meaning, it is not the objective reality that is a problem. It is the motivations that only Hashem and Shmuel knew. We wouldn't know the motivations per se. I think I had mentioned last week the idea of the Nitziv, though. The Nitziv basically says, based on the Chayvas HaLevavos, that the amount of Hashgacha Pratis that you get is commensurate to how much emunah you have in Hashem. The less emunah, the less apparent hashkacha and the more hishtadlus you have to do. The more emunah, the more hashkacha you get and the less hishtadlus you have to do. So the way the Nitziv learns is when you feel as a nation that you need a king, then you must have one. But it was sinful that you needed one in the first place. Meaning, the Nitziv has a nice compromise idea here, and that is, yes, if you're not on that madrega of emunah, you must have a king. But it was sinful for you not to be on that madrega. That's how the Nitziv understands the contradiction between Shmuel's Musar and the mitzvah of appointing a king. Now, the Rambam writes that this... I'm sorry. Awareness is the correct way. Well, it can work both ways, but we could say that the less emunah you have, the less visible and apparent will be the hashgacha pratis in your life. So, for example, of course, there's still going to be hashgacha, but the hashgacha will be masqueraded by all of the teva that you have to do. You'll have to work more, you'll have to have a more of a government, you'll have to have negotiation and political processes. And the reason is because if you're not on the level where you truly believe everything is coming from Hashem, then you're going to live a life where it looks like things are not coming from Hashem. So, and that becomes mandatory. Now, you're mechoyev to live that type of life if you don't change your madrega. And that's what the Nitziv says. So appointing a king is a mitzvah when you don't have the emunah in believing everything comes from Hashem. This is what the Nitziv says. Now, I'm sorry.
So there's a parallel to the Marag.
Exactly right. The Nitziv says Maraglim is exactly the same thing. If you need it, I'm sorry, if you think you need it, then you need it. But you shouldn't have thought that you need it. Right? So... Right? If you think you need it, it becomes a mitzvah, but it was an avera to reach that level of thought. Now, the Rambam writes that this is why although permanent monarchy is supposed to be from the tribe of Yehuda, and that goes back to Yaakov Avinu's blessing, that the scepter of authority should remain in Yehuda. So why is the first king Shaul HaMelech? So the Rambam writes that since their motivation for asking for a king was improper and sinful, Hashem gave them a monarchy that was temporary and designed to fail. They were not zoche for a permanent malchus because they asked shelo kahogen. Now, I'll tell you a kasha on the Rambam. Now, the Rambam seems to indicate to us that Shaul lechatchila had no potential at all for surviving a malchus, because it was a malchus sha'ah, because permanent malchus is only miYehuda. And yet, from the book of Shmuel itself, is it not apparent? Hashem says that if Shaul had carried out the mitzvah to eradicate Amalek, yeah, it says beferish, your malchus would have endured forever. Now, number one, isn't that inconsistent with Yaakov's blessing that malchus belongs to Yehuda? And number two, that means Shaul could have been permanent. So how can the Rambam say it was Malchus? So again, the Ramban says in Parshas Vayechi that certainly, even if Shaul had carried out all of his commandments, the Malchus would have eventually gone to Shevet Yehuda, David HaMelech. But Shaul's descendants would have been, you know, assistants or prime ministers. In fact, somebody even suggested perhaps David would have had children from Michal Bashaul. Remember, David, one of David's wife was Bashaul. And instead of coming from Bathsheba, Shlomo, maybe the Zerah of Malchus Beis David would have come from Michal Bashaul, which would have meant that the Jewish kings were from both David and Shaul. But this is what the Rambam says, that Malchus Shaul was destined to fail because they acted Shelo Kahogen, and therefore they were given a Malchus Lefi Sha'ah. And that is Rumrumas in the Navi Hosea that says, I gave you a Melech Bachamasi. Hashem says, I gave you a king in my anger. As Shmuel is saying it, right? Shaul was a Melech that was given Bachamasi. Let me just mention, though, there is one other Svara. Two other Svaras. Why the first Malchus was not from Shevet Yehuda, right? So the first reason is that since they asked Shelo Kahogen, they were given a temporary Malchus. But there's a second reason that says that the Gemara says in Bava Basra that the children of Rachel are the only ones who could destroy Amalek. That Amalek can never be destroyed by the children of Leah. They can only be destroyed by the children of Rachel. And that is why the war against Amalek in the Midbar is led by Yehoshua ben Nun of Shevet Ephraim. And that is why the first king of the Jewish people is Shaul HaMelech from Binyamin, who is given the commandment to eradicate Amalek. And that is why when he fails, David HaMelech is unable to do so. There are Amalekim around throughout Tanakh. And that is why in the Purim story, it is Mordechai and Esther, who are descended from Shaul, who are given the ability to destroy Haman, who is descended from Agag. And that is why there's Mashiach ben Yosef before Mashiach ben David, because Mashiach ben Yosef's job is to eradicate Amalek and pave the way for Mashiach ben David. There's a deep connection. And sometimes it's Yosef, sometimes it's Binyamin, that's another question. But there's a deep connection between the kayach of Mechias Amalek and the kayach of Rachel to overcome Mechias Amalek. Rachel represents the kayach of selfless love. Right? Rachel was willing to give up her husband, essentially, to her sister Leah. Even though, according to the Ramban, that condemned her to die first, because the Ramban explains that in Eretz Yisrael, Yaakov cannot be married to two sisters because the Torah prohibits it. So whichever sister would have been first married is the one who survives. Rachel made herself the second wife, even if it was a week later. And if she knew all this, she condemned herself to death. It's not just she gave her sister away for a week. So Rachel represents the koach of love. Love going beyond reason. Amalek represents the power of hate. Sinas chinam. Hatred for no reason. We had no land, we had no territory. They had no reason to attack us. And only the koach of Ava without gavul can conquer the power and negativity of hatred without gavul. So Zerah Amalek is defeated by the koach of Rachel, and that is why, as great as David HaMelech was, there needed to be a Shaul as a precursor. But Shaul didn't fulfill his mission, so David was actually disabled from doing so until the Purim story and the like. So that's the second reason why there needed to be this provisional king Shaul, Lahachris Zaro Shel Amalek, although the job wasn't done. And the third reason is a political reason, but it doesn't make sense. And that, as I had mentioned before, that the incident of Pilegesh Begiba, the concubine, this was a woman that was raped, and then she died, and she was cut up into pieces with one piece male to each shevet to show what a bad thing shevet the Binyamin did. And all the tribes demanded extradition of the offenders. And the Ramban says Shevet Binyamin refused to extradite because they said, we are a sovereign nation. We'll judge our own people. It's actually a civil war issue here. The issue is, are we one nation or are we 12 nations? And Shevet Binyamin was almost totally decimated, totally destroyed. Only a few hundred people. And people even made a shavua that they would not allow their children to intermarry with Binyamin, and that would have meant an extinction of a tribe. But on the 15th of Av, we have a Masorah that Pinchas annulled that shavua and they could marry. That's why one of the reasons the 15th of Av is a marriage day and the like. So it could very well be that the resentments and the hatreds against Shevet Binyamin were so great that Hashem wanted to elevate a Binyaminite to be king, to bring Binyamin back into the fold. Right? So there was kind of a political reason that Kodesh Baruch had a cheshbon to elevate Binyamin in the eyes. In fact, it's reminiscent, Lahavdil, of Abraham Lincoln in his second term. Andrew Johnson, the senator from Tennessee, was his vice president. Andrew Johnson became president when Lincoln was assassinated. Now, Andrew Johnson was from a state that had rebelled against the Union, Tennessee. And the concept was that Lincoln wanted to show that even the rebellious states are back into the fold. So Lahavdil, a similar dynamic could have applied by Shaul HaMelech, that Binyamin that had rebelled goes back into the fold. It's interesting that I have read that before the American Civil War, the United States was a plural noun, meaning the United States, say, meaning a bunch of different states. And after the Civil War, it became a singular noun. The United States says, a different hasaga. Now, fascinatingly, according to the Ramban, that was actually the issue of Pilegesh Begiva. It's very fascinating to compare these things politically. Pilegesh Begiva, Binyamin refused to extradite, so to speak, the wrongdoers, because Binyamin took the position, yeah, we all have a Torah, we all have a common religion, but we are 12 different nations. Each tribe is a separate nation. Just like there are, you know, Jews in Israel and Jews in America, or Catholics in Italy and Catholics in France. We're not the same country. So essentially, Shevet Binyamin's argument was, politically, we are not the same country. Remember, there was no king, right? Every you know, tribe, etc. And therefore, you don't have a right to judge people who commit crimes in our jurisdiction. Pilegesh Begiva actually established an important political proposition that the Jewish people are not only a single religion, they are a single nation. And as a result, they are one, even though there are Shvatim and the like. So it's very, very interesting that there's a parallel to the Civil War. But be it as it may, these are the different reasons why there was a provisional Malchus of Binyamin. Again, according to the Rambam, since they asked for an improper reason, they get an improper Malchus. According to others, it's to eradicate Amalek through the Kayach of Zerah Rachel. And according to a third interpretation, it is the idea of bringing back Binyamin as part of Am Yisrael. Now let me just mention one final shita. The Abarbanel interprets the whole parsha of Melech Keneged Chazal. Right? Chazal assume having a Melech is a mitzvah, and then it has to ask the kasha, why is Shmuel so upset? And we have to talk about motivation. Abarbanel says, no, having a king is not a mitzvah at all. It's, if you want one, Hashem allows you to have one, but it's not good to have a king. And it's very, very fascinating that the Abarbanel talks about a king is an abuse of power. And it's very fascinating. The Abarbanel is writing this very autobiographically, and he says he's writing it autobiographically. The Abarbanel, you will remember, was the finance minister of Spain in 1492. He raised the money for the Columbus expedition to India, which became the discovery of the New World, etc. And when Ferdinand and Isabella expelled all the Jews who refused to convert to Christianity, they made an exception for the Abarbanel because he was their money man. He could have stayed, but he refused to stay. And in his 70s, he first went to Portugal, and then he went to his sons in Italy, and he was remarkably impressed by the Italian city-states. He writes in his Perush on Shmuel that they had term limits, they had elected officials who could only serve for a certain number of years, and then they were rotated back, and he said, that's a wonderful system, because then you're accountable to your electorate, and you can't really abuse your position, because in a few years you're going to be judged by them. And he says, so much better than the monarchies of which I have very great familiarity with, Ferdinand and Isabella. And he actually writes that a melech is no good. And therefore he says that the Torah never said there was a mitzvah to have a king. It permitted you to have a king. Much, much better not to. Now, the problem with the Abarbanel is, on one hand, the Abarbanel is an anti-monarchist. He is a pro-Republican, Republican meaning pro-Republican form of government. And yet, the Abarbanel also wrote extensively on the Melech HaMashiach. I mean, it's hard to understand exactly where Mashiach fits in here, because if the Abarbanel is saying that the Torah's ideal would be not to have a king at all, then the Torah's ideal is there wouldn't have been a David HaMelech. If there wouldn't have been a David HaMelech, now clearly there's going to be a Mashiach, but then it wouldn't have been Mashiach ben David. How would that work? So it's a little hard to fit these two pieces together, the anti-monarchical piece of the Abarbanel with the fact that the Abarbanel was not only a believer in Mashiach, of course, but the Abarbanel was the greatest writer on Yemos HaMashiach. The Abarbanel wrote, of any Rishon, he wrote the greatest number of pages on the notion of the idea of Mashiach. He was really one of the great, great expounders of the idea of Mashiach in Klal Yisrael. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't think Jews fail more often. I think human beings fail. I think it's really a characteristic of human beings that we have lofty ideas and we fail to turn them into concrete realities. Also, it might be the quality that the Torah calls that Yidden are Am Kishei Orif. Now, Am Kishei Orif, we're a stiff-necked, we're a stubborn person. Now, stubbornness can help you very well when you're facing a hostile world, but stubbornness can also mean that you're very resistant to change your ways. In fact, the Gemara tells us the amazing statement. Yaina, remember, Yaina was given the mission to go to Nineveh and tell them to do tshuva. And Yaina didn't want to go. And the Gemara says, Yaina didn't want to go because he figured, aye, the Goyim will do tshuva and Hashem will have rachamim, and then the Jews don't do tshuva, so it'll be a real kitrik. And the Gemara has a lashon. Umos ha'olam krovin l'tshuva yosher mi'Yisrael. The Goyim are more prone to do tshuva quickly than our Jews. What's the pshat? Because once again, they're not as tough, so to speak, so their moods change. When they get into a spiritual mood, they'll become religious one day, and then they'll drop it. With a Jew, you know, Jews are stubborn. That enables our survival, but it also means that it's harder to change us in many ways. And this you see throughout the Torah. Yeah. Yeah. So be as I just want to end with one thing, that on one hand, the Haftarah goes into three different moods. It starts off with the jubilation of Chidush HaMelucha. Shmuel puts a damper on it by reminding them of their lack of faith. And he shows a sign from heaven that God is not happy with their choices, with the rain that's coming down in the middle of the wheat harvest. But then Shmuel gives them words of reassurance. He says, you know, you shouldn't have asked for a king. It shows a lack of emunah, but the situation is salvageable. We're not going to take away the king. You need it. But if you're king and you understand that your purpose in life is to serve Hashem, then Hashem will bless you in all that you do. And we have the famous pasuk that we say, well, actually in Eretz Yisrael we don't say it, but in Chutz La'aretz we have an extra bracha at the end of Ma'ariv, Ki lo yitosh Hashem es amo bavor shmo hagadol. Hashem will not forsake his nation in the merit of his holy name. And that is Hashem's promise to us. And Shmuel's really almost last words are that great message of hope and trust that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help us even when we make mistakes, as long as we truly try to serve him. So have a good week.